So if you can make one generic T cell that can respond to each different type of cancer, you can now mass produce these cells and inject them into the patient and cure the cancer that way.
Hi, welcome to episode 2. Today we're speaking with Nicole Derringer. I strongly encourage you to listen to the previous episode with Tyler Ford, where we discuss a lot of the basics of how to engineer a cell. If you want to jump right in, go ahead. So Nicole, I actually know her from my day-to-day life. We both work long hours in the cell culture room. So I've been chit-chatting with her for the last couple years and been learning about her project piecemeal. It was nice to sit down with Nicole and just get the full view of her work and what she's doing. So what I like about Nicole's work is in her PhD, she designed a very simple receptor where when the receptor bound its target, a protein was cleaved that automatically led to gene expression in one step. And what Nicole is working on now is creating what's called a signaling cascade between the receptor binding its target and downstream gene expression. Cells do this naturally, and this is how they can incorporate information from multiple receptors. So adding this next level of complexity is going to be important for us engineering sophisticated receptors in the future. So without further ado, here's my interview with Nicole, and hope you enjoy.
Glimpse.
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 I can't do it.
I'm Nicole Derringer from Jim Collins Lab at MIT in the Institute of Medical Engineering and Science.
Where did this all start? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a very rural area in Iowa, surrounded by cornfields, near Waterloo, Iowa. And so I just spent a lot of time climbing trees, running around, digging in the dirt.
Cool. So do you remember what you wanted to be when you were growing up?
The first thing I remember wanting to be is actually a neurosurgeon.
Okay.
In part because I wanted to be a doctor and I was interested in the brain, and I think probably knowing my childhood self in part because it sounds really impressive. And what happened is when I was still in high school, my sister worked in a lab at University of Iowa in the psychology department doing, like, studying the mouse brain and how it works and everything. Saw her lab and I just thought it was really, really cool. Like, research just seems so fascinating.
Do you remember your first experience in a research lab?
I was just looking at different ways to filter corn steep water, just to separate the most useful parts of it. Research is sometimes long and tedious. It's really interesting. I've always really enjoyed learning, and this is a way that I can just continue learning forever. So I went into grad school. The shortest summer is just developing synthetic receptors to drive transcription of genes in response to extracellular signals. My first main project actually failed, but I did get one paper out of it. We were working on trying to develop chimeric receptors. So you fuse two different receptors together and then try and activate one response in response to a different signal.
So you would take the binding portion of one receptor and fuse it to the part that triggers all of the response.
Yes.
Okay.
And what we found is that even the receptors, we think we know how they work really well. They don't always work the way we thought they do.
Okay.
And it just didn't work well. And what I ended up doing is then just completely bypassing all the things, all the normal processes the cells use, make a receptor that's completely synthetic, we kind of piecing together different proteins for what we want, but they're not, they don't have any components of native receptors. They don't interact with native receptors. And then just bypass all the signaling circuits and go straight to transcribing a gene of interest, which in the beginning was just making the cells turn color.
So the first project was, let's take pieces of different receptors and stick them together to try to make a Frankenstein, but engineered Frankenstein receptor. But in the second step, you said, let's just take building blocks of proteins, smush them together, and create like a completely artificial receptor that bound to something that you knew it would bind to. If I had to design a receptor from scratch, how would I even do this?
So the easiest mechanism for activating receptors is just to induce dimerization.
Just to make an analogy, it's like a tennis ball. One hand grabs it, nothing happens. But when the second hand grabs it, let's say the touching of the elbows is what would create, activate whatever happens inside the cell.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So that's dimerization, and that's one of the most simple.
Yes. And so we would use either proteins that are already known to dimerize and response to a certain signal, or we could use antibodies, actually, a little portion of the antibodies that recognize the protein we're interested in. And if we can get two different antibodies to recognize the same protein, or some proteins are pieced together so they're kind of mirror image stuck together, and so you can get the same antibody that binds on now each side of the mirror image, and that would bring together the receptors. It was on one half of the receptor, it was a protease, which is just a protein that cuts apart other proteins. And then on the other half of the receptor was what the protease cuts attached to a transcription factor.
Oh.
So they come together, the protease cleaves the other side, releases the transcription factor, and then we can go on to express any gene we're interested in.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. I'm going to try to relate this to my analogy. So you have your tennis ball. It'll bind to two hands. The elbows touch. And at the tip of the elbow, you have a pair of scissors and like a key dangling from a string. The protease, which is the scissor, will cleave a small sequence, releasing the key, the transcription factor, and that'll do whatever it's supposed to do. Is that sort of a good approximation? Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It took forever to get this working.
Okay.
If you think it's hard kind of modifying native receptors, trying to make something completely brand new without the aid of thousands of years of evolution was actually really difficult.
I feel like I did not do my duty as an interviewer. I think we're in the middle of some synthetic biology. So can you maybe just give us like an overview of what synthetic biology is?
But the way I like to look at it is in general biology, we're trying to understand how the cells work, what all the little pieces do, how they work together, trying to figure out what causes things to go wrong and how to fix them.
Yeah.
And synthetic biology, one of our goals is to just recreate what cells can already do, either using similar methods or completely different methods. And this can help us understand biology better. And then we can use this understanding now to make cells do something completely new.
So with synthetic biology, was that always the goal from the beginning? Like, let's build things from the ground up to see, you know, what we can do and then fail and then learn more about bio? Or was there also like ambition of, oh, we're going to use this to, I don't know, cure cancer or clean up oil spills?
I think there were early hopes of being able to use it to do really important things like that. But a lot of the early synthetic biology was just kind of, let's see what we can do.
Okay.
We combine these pieces in different ways and now look, we can make this happen.
Gotcha. And so that was grad school. So tell us what you're working on now in your postdoc in the Jim Collins lab.
Rather than now having the protease scissors and the key released on the other half, we're taking part of the cell's normal signaling components and we're fusing one half to one side of the receptor, another half to the other side of the receptor. And when the receptors come together, there's a small chemical modification of the protein and it's called phosphorylation. Cells use these modifications to transmit the information. It's just very small. You add one little chemical to the protein, and then you can remove it, and that triggers all these other reactions. And so now when the receptors come together, it starts this reaction and trigger our own signaling cascade. One of the functions of the signaling cascade is to amplify a signal. So even a really weak activation can lead to a really strong response in the cell. So we can do that with our system. Another function is that because each step is reversible, now we can tune the response of the cell. So we can turn it down a little bit at any of the steps. We can turn it completely off at any of the steps. So we combined my experience building the other type of synthetic receptor with the person I'm working with, Caleb Basher, who has a very strong biochemistry background, lots of knowledge of the different components that are used in the signaling cascades in cells. And then combining our two expertise, we were able to develop this new mechanism for synthetic receptors and the signaling cascades.
Having worked on building these from the ground up, have you had any insights into how wonderfully beautiful our native receptors are? Like, what's the biggest discovery that you've reverse engineered?
There's nothing yet. I think that there's no big aha or no big discovery yet. But what I'm really hoping to do is I'm applying for faculty jobs right now and I want to start my own lab and I want to use this tool to study immune response. Cells often receive mixed signals and have to decide what to do with that. And that's especially important in immune cells because in something like cancer, the cancer can overwrite the cell's response to attack the cancer and instead it actually gets the immune cells to help the cancer to grow. So using these circuits in the immune cells or in the cancer, we can study both how the cells are making their decisions and then potentially use that to overwrite what the tumor's telling the cells to do and now tell the cells to attack the cancer. When you're working with the immune cell system, tight control is really important.
Yeah.
If the immune system reacts too strongly,
Two weekly leads to cancer, too strongly leads to autoimmune disease or allergies. Yeah. Yeah.
And so our system, I think, will enable the tight control of the cell response that you need for a safer, more effective therapy. Cancer has always been my strongest interest. There's other, like you mentioned, the autoimmune diseases, other types of diseases that involve the immune system not functioning correctly. This could be used for those. And it could also just be used for a really wide range of scientific questions about how cells decide what they're going to do. And that's not something that I will be doing in my own lab, but I really hope to be able to do that in combination with other researchers in their labs. So find someone who's interested in this other problem and now modify my circuits to help with their problem. And that's actually another thing I like about this project is my interests are so broad. I just love learning anything about biology, the complexity of biology. So now having this very generic tool that I can apply to all kinds of areas of science, I can have the opportunity just to learn more.
What do you think the limit right now is?
Our basic system right now is kind of a proof of concept, saying like, here's all the pieces we have, here's what we can make them do, this is how we can change how the cell responds. And so in the future, what I'll have to do is expand it so now it can integrate multiple signals, and we want to be able to tie into the native cell circuit, so we'll have to work on expanding that direction. Rather than just making the cells turn colors in response to that, we want them to be able to express different genes with different functions within the cell.
To cure the cancer. Okay.
So we'll need lots of new inputs and outputs in our little circuit.
I see. So it sounds like the ultimate goal of this is to sort of graft like a new receptor that replugs back into the cell's own natural circuits or pathways. So if we fast forward into the future, is the vision for this technology that you would pull a patient's cells out, you would give them a cocktail of different DNA to make them express these synthetic receptors, re-inject them back into the patient and have them be therapeutic or sentinels?
Using the technology that's currently available, that would be the long-term vision. Going forward, what some synthetic biologists are working toward and what the system would, I think, work well with is developing immune cells that can be used for everyone with this type of cancer. So you don't even have to take the patient's immune cells out and put them back in. But this is actually a really expensive way to treat the cancer. So if you can make one generic T cell that can respond to like each different type of cancer, you can now mass produce these cells and inject them into the patient and cure the cancer that way.
Okay.
And I think that's a lot further out, but it's definitely a more effective, cheaper, easier access treatment for cancer.
Man, that's cool. So cells as the therapy, like not your own cells, you just have a little vial of just magic cure cells and give those to patients. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you're in an interesting position. I know that most synthetic biology starts in bacteria. You can poke them a lot more than a mammalian cell. Is there a substantial number of people that have moved into mammalian synthetic bio? I mean, it seems like a natural progression, but is the field still 90%, 10%?
It's still the majority of people working bacteria, but not 90%, 10% anymore. Because although bacteria is a lot easier to work with, mammalian cells have a lot more potential useful applications.
All right. I'd like to finish these interviews with the lightning round questions. Is there a misconception that you often have to address when speaking to non-scientists?
Science is not evil. GMOs are not bad. Vaccines don't cause autism. There's a lot of inherent mistrust of science. I think it's in part because unless if you understand the fine details of what's being done and how and why, it can seem like we're just throwing things together. We don't know how it works, what's going to happen, and then we just throw it out into the environment, and whatever happens, happens.
Right. So the GMO thing, I think you're perfect, position to talk about this a little more. I would say, as a well-read person on this topic, you said GMOs are not evil. They're not evil per se, but sometimes we're a little bit quick to release things, and we might not know the full consequences. Do you have a counter response to that?
I do. So actually, most of the modifications we're making and these typically crops, farm plants, is that we're taking a very small, well-defined piece of one plant and we're transferring it into the other plant. So normally we would have to breed these changes into the plants, but now we just know exactly what this one piece does. We put it in this other plant. So it's just as safe in one plant as it is in the other.
Right. So instead of waiting, you know, 30 generations of farmers to get that magical tomato seed, you can just engineer it in a lab, take the property from this tomato, put it in another. Okay. That is very safe. But GMO can apply to a number of different things. So I know there's like gene drives and things like that that are popping up in the news a lot. Are there committees in place to kind of monitor this sort of thing? I remember there was a paper about a year or two ago where they were talking about just having a general off switch in any sort of engineered bacteria or strain to make sure that, you know, if it takes over the ecosystem, let's say, we can just turn it off. I don't know, is that...
There's actually a lot of synthetic biology research going into just that.
Okay.
They call them kill switches. So either adding a signal to the cell kills them, or in some cases removing something from the cells. So there's only something the cells can only have in the lab. They can't grow without it. So if they get out into the wild, they no longer have access to this and they just die out automatically.
I see.
So there's a lot of safety mechanisms built into these systems.
So GMO, not evil. Yeah, all right. is there a task in the lab that brings you an irrational amount of joy?
The two things that bring me the most irrational joy is, one, when I'm making the liquid that my cells grow in, it changes colors from orange to red. And for some reason, even now, it just is fun.
You know, I used to have the same joy when I used to make nanoparticles in my old lab. It would go from black to purple to Kool-Aid red. It was really fascinating. Yeah, color changes.
I think most of science, since we can't actually see what we're doing, just anything we can actually see is really cool.
Yeah.
And the other thing is just pouring out the right number of tubes. If I have a jar full of tubes and I need 30 tubes and I just happen to pour out 30 tubes, it's just
perfect.
It's perfect.
Yeah. So science is hard.
Yes.
No news there. What keeps you going?
Just taking baby steps, I think. Like, occasionally you have to stop and think big picture, but for the day-to-day things, it's best just to think one. For me, it's best just to think one step at a time. And then it's easier to keep going, even when things aren't working well.
Gotcha. That's I like that. and what is your best skill as a researcher?
It's actually only a benefit in research, but I'm really good at overthinking everything.
Especially in biology and cell culture. I learned this when I first got my master's. So fresh out of undergrad, the number one lesson from my master's was trust no one.
Yes.
Just, you know, make your own everything. If someone else is entrusted with something, there's a chance that it might fail.
Yes. Yeah. And then I've already, because I'm overthinking everything, I already know all the most likely ways that my experiments might fail. I've already decided what to do next.
Yeah.
But anywhere else in life, it's just, it's a big burden, but it works well for science.
And so what has been your biggest challenge so far?
I think my biggest challenge isn't science itself, but actually my personal life. So I had two children as an undergrad, and my husband was deployed half of that time. And then, coming from a big family, we wanted more kids. So we had our third child between undergrad and graduate school, and then a fourth child right after my qualifying exams in graduate school. So just trying to balance four kids and projects that are really challenging, sometimes time-consuming, and just finding the best balance has been a challenge.
So do you have any tips? I mean, that seems like some Jedi-level time management skills that you need to balance all these things together.
I've learned to prioritize. I haven't always made the right decisions on what I thought was the highest priority, but learning to prioritize, balance what needs done. I only have time to do so much, so I just pick what I think is most important. I do that, and I worry about the rest later. And then also just keeping in mind that I'm not living to work. I'm working to live.
Mm.
So although there's a mentality in science that science comes first, everything else isn't important, my kids are what's important. My family's what's important.
Right.
And I enjoy the science, but that's not my life.
Right. And from what you've said in this interview, you enjoy science a lot.
I do.
Well, that's kind of a nice benefit, right? Nice family, career you enjoy. Yeah, hopefully. It's great. Do you have a story about a spectacular or hilarious failure? either early days of science or...
The biggest failure I can think of was actually recent, and you probably remember this day. I had done a very big experiment, probably close to the biggest experiment I've ever done. 3 really long days worth of work. Just very time consuming. Yeah. A lot of thought had gone into it. And then when I was going to take my cells out and measure them, instead of adding what I would normally add, I grabbed the wrong bottle because it was on the wrong spot, and I added pure water to my cells.
Oh, I remember this.
And I added it to the first 2 plates. The cells just completely...
Disappeared.
Yeah. Turned into big clumps that I had no idea what had happened. And so then I bleached the rest of the experiment, only to realize 2 hours later what I had done. And I could have rescued most of the experiment if I hadn't bleached the cells. And it wasn't hilarious, but... kind of was.
That sounds horrible. I'm so sorry. So... Have you had any role models along the way?
I have. The 2 biggest role models in my life. One, as I was growing up when I was young, my oldest sister is actually my role model. She's very intelligent. She was good at all the things I wanted to be good at. So I tried to be just like her. And being 5 years older than me, she probably either just didn't notice at all or she thought I was a copycat and I probably really annoyed her. But I just really looked up to her and I wanted to be just like her. The second one is actually my mom. And this was more as I was... growing up, especially once I had my own kids, she in high school was never encouraged to go to college. She, after having 6 kids, when my youngest sister was 2 years old, my mom decided she wanted to go to college. So she ended up getting a degree in school psychology, becoming a school psychologist for several years, and then went back to school, got a PhD in educational administration with an emphasis in special ed, and was an administrator, and just growing up the whole time, I see my mom in college. Just so education was very important in our family. And then once I had kids, even though I was an undergrad, I never even once considered dropping out of college or not continuing my education. It's just, it seemed perfectly normal to me that a parent would be in college.
Wow. So this miraculous 4 kids and doing a postdoc in the Jim Collins lab is sort of a... Because of your mom.
Very much so.
I think most people would think that's impossible.
Yeah. And my mom had done it. I knew it could be done. She did it with 6 kids. Much more patience with us than I could ever have. And even now, I still call her for advice regularly when something's with my kids.
And the last question I'd like to end on is, what's the best advice you ever received?
The 2 best pieces of advice. One is just don't live to work. Work to live. And then the other one is just... take things one step at a time. So when I was coming into graduate school, I thought academics seemed interesting. I thought maybe someday I'll want to be a professor. But looking at a professor and trying to picture myself as a professor was just really overwhelming.
Yep.
There's no way I thought I could ever do that. So someone gave me advice, just take it one step at a time. So work towards your research, make progress on your research, work towards your dissertation, get that done. Postdoc comes next, and then someday you'll feel like you're ready to be a professor.
Did you feel that at a specific moment, or are you just still focusing on the next step? Find a position, write your grants?
I didn't really feel like I was ready to be a professor until I actually started applying for the JAMS. So that when you're applying for JAMS, you put together a huge package. This is what I've done. This is what I'm going to do. And you have to convince people that you can do it. And then the process of trying to convince other people, I actually convinced myself.
Yeah. I've heard that from a few people. It's hard work to put your package together, but it does give you a bit of an ego boost. So yeah. That's always nice. Okay. No, this is some great advice. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I would like to thank everyone who helped make Glimpse Podcast possible. Music production by Kevin McLeod. Funding provided by the MIT Postdoctoral Association. For episode information, links, and show notes, please check out our website, glimpse.mit.edu. Thanks for listening.